And it was about 100 years, exactly 100 years this month, when one of our early pioneers arrived in Grand Marais. He came up here looking for a wilder place. He arrived on the ship America. Of course, back then, there was no road to Grand Marais. It was the way you got here. He was met on the dock by Charlie Johnson's pet moose with his bright red ribbons in his hair and proceeded to walk up 32 miles to the Gunflint Trail, Hungry Jack Lake, I believe, at that time. He went back to Malacca, picked up his belongings at some point, and came back here to carve out a life trapping, guiding, hunting, fishing. He was a lumberjack, a game warden, a builder, a lodge owner. And, of course, he didn't do that all alone. His wife, Petra, and 10 children were there to help him. And we're so happy to have one of those children in our studio tonight, and that is Harriet Boostrom Taus. Harriet, I want to thank you so much for coming here tonight and being on Roadhouse.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. That's as I read that off and think back 100 years and think of somebody landing here on a boat, walking the 32 miles up to make out a living, going back to Malacca after a couple years and picking up a waitress he'd met from Malacca who agreed to marry him and come back up here and live in a tent on Moon Lake. I'm just kind of a little bit awestruck. Even you as one of his children have to be pretty amazed at that beginning that your parents made.
Right. When my dad first came up here to live with the Indians, he asked my mom to marry him and come with. But she said, oh, I don't think I can live in a tent. But if you build a cabin, I'll come. And so he went and he lived with the Indians and he learned their ways. And he got to know the lakes and the forests and he could tell the weather and he just learned how to be an Indian. And the Indians later on said he got to be a better Indian than a lot of them.
Oh.
And I suppose it's because he was very young and ambitious, you know.
Sure.
But he homesteaded a lot on Moon Lake and built a cabin. And when he got the cabin done, then he went back to Malacca in August of 1913. And my mom came with him. And we children often wondered after. My dad and mom never really talked about them being early pioneers, you know. And so it was after they were gone. But I often wondered if my dad told my mom that she was going to have to walk 30 miles to this cabin.
It's pretty amazing story, really.
Right.
And such an amazing woman, your mother, to agree to that type of life,
right,
to leave a comfortable place in Malacca,
mm-hmm,
and face an unknown such as living,
right,
in the woods. It is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. He had found Clearwater Lake with his trappings. Those 2 years he lived with the Indians, he trapped, got many furs. And so the Indians were right. He really made a good living. And he had found Clearwater Lake. And he thought it was the prettiest lake up here, the coldest, deepest, clearest lake. And so when my mom came, he had to bring her to show her Clearwater Lake. Now that was seven lakes from Moon Lake. And so they started out and went to Clearwater, and she wanted to bake bread because they, you know, had just come. And he said, well, mix the bread up and we'll take it with us. And when we get, after it raises, we'll go to shore and bake it. And my mother kept, this is the only story my mother told about that. She said she kept wondering, how is he going to break this bread out on the shore, you know? And so when the bread was finally ready to raise, she said, Charlie, the bread's ready. She said he just went to shore, didn't pick out a certain spot or nothing. And then he proceeded to build this fire with a tunnel where the wind would come up, and she couldn't figure out what he was doing. And so now the wood, this wood, you can't use this kind of wood because that burns too hot. It'll burn the bread. You got to burn this kind of wood because that burns slow and steady. And so then she still was wondering how he was going to bake this bread. And then she said he went to his pack and got out this contraption. And it was a reflector oven that the Indians used. Mm-hmm. And he set it up and baked the bread. And she couldn't believe it. So that was her. That's the only story she ever told us. Uh-huh. And we, as children, just never thought that they were early pioneers or, you know, so we never thought to ask them any questions until it was too late.
Sure. Well, you think of them as your mother and father, of course, and it's hard to grasp right. How they are viewed from other folks.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Now, as I understand it, then they built their first cabin or first lodge, small lodge on Clearwater mm-hmm. around 1915, and then they took a couple of summers off from their trapping and just went traveling in canoes.
They went all the way from here to International Falls. And he wanted to do that as soon as he had a helpmate. And then, so they were planning to do that. They were married in August, and they were going to do that the next spring. Well, then guess what? She was going to have a baby. So now they had to wait a year. And they took that trip with that little boy, 9, 10 months old. Can you imagine? Mm. But I suppose he probably had him in a little papoose thing like the Indians did. And yeah. So they paddled around. Now, we never knew about that until I had a cousin who came up here and helped my dad a lot during the Depression. And he took the reindeer to the cities and played Santa Claus. My dad didn't like doing that. And so Clifford would do that. Well, after Clifford died, his wife gave me a box of clippings. And there was this article in the paper about 1921 that told this story. And we never knew that when my folks were alive.
You know, you brought up the reindeer, and a team of reindeer was something that your father introduced to this country and fed them and kept them up there mm-hmm. and did. You mentioned the cousin, but he also, I believe, went down and entertained the young children in Grand Marais mm-hmm. with that team.
Yeah, and he went to Duluth, and he even went to Minneapolis, and he thought it was too civilized for him.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, the Depression came, and he couldn't afford to feed them anymore, and that was, they disappeared in the wild.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He also had, he and your mother, Petra, had dog team. Mm-hmm. That they used, I assume, for coming back and forth to town?
Right. When my dad first came, he did a lot of fishing and guiding people that came to Grand Marais. And there wasn't anybody in Grand Marais that wanted to do that. So they said, there's a white man that went to live with the Indians up there. You find him, he'll take you. And so that's how my dad started the resort business. These people, and they all came and walked or came by water. And so he had a good start by the time my mom came. And so those early years, he walked to town once a month to get the mail and get supplies.
32 miles.
32 miles.
Yeah.
And he carried the supplies back. And in the fall, he had 300-pound packs that he carried. And it took him 2 days to come back. He could make it to town in a day. But coming home, it took 3 days. Mm. And then they lived on the wild game, of course, and fish, but dried beans, dried peas, rice, everything, you know, like that, oatmeal, cornmeal, and flour and sugar. That's what he brought from town. But he did that until 1918, between 1918 and 1920, when they started, the mail was delivered to Hungry Jack, and a wagon train went up there, and then he could order his supplies. So when he built the resort in 1924, he started, finished in 26, he got all the bed springs and windows and everything on that wagon train. So it was really wonderful, because otherwise he carried everything from Grand Marais.
It's an amazing story.
Right.
Now, you are one of 10 children.
Mm-hmm. I'm number 8.
You were number 8 in what became a very busy resort
right.
over the years. What was that life like for you?
Oh, it was wonderful when I was a kid, you know. One thing that was funny was we all worked really hard. My brothers chopped wood. We just did something all the time, you know. And I remember my sister and I had a sister 2 years older. That's Gloria's mother, the baker now. And And we would talk about all these people who worked, and they were off of work, so now they came on vacation. And we wondered what it would be like to work.
We didn't
realize that we were working.
You were working harder than the other people even thought of.
Right. But it was fun. And, you know, my dad was, he dug a well under the resort, under the kitchen, and so we had running water. And when he built the lodge, there were 14 rooms upstairs, and he had room for a bathroom. And when people came then, they just, up until that time, he had put up tents for the people to come. And he and my mom and brothers and sisters moved out of the little cabin, and my mom cooked and fed everybody in there. And so now he built this big resort, and there were 14 rooms upstairs. And there was room for a bathroom, and so he intended to put it in someday.
Didn't happen right away.
Right. And so now he had a big enough place, and I said to my oldest sister one time, I was visiting her in Florida, and I said, I wonder how come my dad had that much, how come he had such foresight to build that big resort when there wasn't even a road in there. When the resort was done, he went to the county board, and they allotted $1,500 to build the 4 miles in from the Gunflint to Clearwater. And so they got the road in there. And my sister said, Harriet, foresight, he just got tired of pitching all those tents. So maybe that was true. But he was really a progressive person. And he just did wonderful things after they put up ice. And he had an engine going and a conveyor belt that they'd put the ice on, and it would go right up to the ice house. And then he started a mill and made his own lumber and stuff. And, of course, he continued to build log cabins. One thing about that resort, it was built, there's no nails in it at all. It was all built the way the Indians built log cabins.
I know from reading a little bit that he had built, I think, 41 cabins during his career, and these were done kind of as a sideline. This
right.
wasn't his career.
No.
He built the lodge as well. He built a house. He built built the Ski Hill Lodge here in Grand
mm-hmm.
Marais.
Yeah, and wasn't that a shame that they didn't take care of it?
Mm-hmm.
And it just rotted.
And that went away. But to think of the energy your father must had to run a resort, to trap, to fish, to build all these cabins
right.
for people when he didn't have other things going,
right.
it boggles one's mind
right.
today.
And you know, back in the early years, when there was a fire, the men had logging camps, and all the men would work and take out those burnt trees. And so my dad did that several years. My mom cooked for them all, and he'd pitch a tent, and they lived in a tent out, you know, like down at Rose Lake after Rose Lake burnt. And they don't do that anymore, but it was a livelihood for them, you know. They lived in tents. I tell you, it was just unbelievable to think that these men would come and work and live in a tent all winter. So
yeah.
They were hardy people.
They're very hardy people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as we're on that topic, your mother kept a journal. And
yes.
I happen to have Beatrice Ogren's book here that put a few items in that
mm-hmm.
journal.
Right.
And just to give the folks a hint of what kind of energy your mother had, and I'm sure your whole family followed suit. There was one entry in 1965. Your mother at that time would have been 75 years old.
Right.
It says here for August 26th, went to Marlene's, that's your sister's, canned 14 pints of raspberries for her, cleaned up the dishes and so on, mended 9 shirts, a pair of pants and another shirt, went to the hospital, had my blood tested, and Alta and I went to the fair. All this in the morning. I read through this thing and that's what it's like.
Right, yeah.
Now that must have been what life was like for you.
Right.
In that lodge setting.
Mm-hmm, it was. But my dad was really progressive. In the early, sometimes in the 20s, I'm not sure when, he got a generator in. And of course, you know, the Gunflint Trail didn't get electricity till 1957. And so all of the resorts at that time had their own generators. and they had a storage battery that they stored up this energy, and that furnished electricity for the bathrooms and the showers to work. My dad had put in a community bathroom and shower, kind of like the campgrounds have now for all the cabins. And none of the he built 9 cabins for the lodge. None of the cabins at first had kitchens because all the people took their meals at the, my mom cooked for them all. And so then when they started coming and wanting, you know, kitchens in there so they could do some of their cooking, they just put a hot plate, a little area off the living room. And so they've had quite a job kind of redoing the cabins.
Sure.
But well, it's a long time, you know.
You know, when most of us think of those times, we think of a much simpler life. What does that mean to you, a simpler life in those times?
Well, we boarded out to go to school. And I guess our time up there was, we came down on Sunday afternoon, and then I had two brothers when I was going to school. I had two brothers that went to high school, and they picked us up on Maple Hill and brought us home. And it was a job getting home. The roads were never plowed, and we shoveled and pushed up every hill. And so I guess life was simpler. But, you know, we all had fun, too. You know, we played in the snow, and we skated, and we skied. And then for pin money, we all trapped. And so we all had a trap line, and my dad taught us how to skin the weasel and mink and put them on these stretchers. And so it was probably simpler, but it was, you know,
It was a busy life.
Right, it was.
Mm-hmm. As I read through your mother's journal, something clicked to me. As I talk about the way the weather used to be, I think more snow, colder temperatures. But I was reading in her journal, it was like 55 below, 40 below. She talks about one time all her water jugs that she put on the picture window sill cracked and broke. Right. It was so cold that night. That's inside.
Right.
What's your impression of that?
Well, it was cold. We slept in the upstairs at the lodge, never any heat up there. And so my mother had bricks for all of us, and she'd put them in the oven. And when we went to school, we had that brick by our feet in the car. And when we went to bed, it was wrapped in a towel, and we each took a brick to bed with us.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And we couldn't have our hair wet because it would freeze. So I guess we just got used to it, you know.
How do you think a lot of these experiences shaped your life differently than the average person out there? Have you thought about that much?
Well, I don't know. My mom was really good at raising children. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because when we came home on Friday night, we all had to sit around this table and have dinner. She always had something in the oven. And then we'd tell what happened at school. And when we went to school, my mom said, "Now you're down there by yourself. We have no phone. There's no way we'll ever come to school. So if anybody, you have to stick up for yourself. If anybody does anything you don't like, you got to speak up. And if you don't speak up to them, you don't tell it to another soul. You never talk about what anybody does unless you've confronted them." Such good lessons for life, you know. I mean, to this day, I think of that, you know. But it was funny because I had a brother who just got in a lot of mischief. And so we'd be home talking about what had happened, you know. And my mother would say, "Roscoe, do you have something to say?" And, of course, then he'd have to confess. Well, I thought parents had built-in radar, that they just knew. And it wasn't until I got to be parent myself that I realized that he gave it away, you know.
You figured all that out.
Right.
That's just great. We're speaking with Harriet Boostrom Taus, and Harriet, one of 10 children that Charlie and Petra Boostrom, two of our pioneers in this county, had. Harriet, as far as your life now, as I mentioned before we came on air, even in my lifetimes, things have changed so dramatically. What were some of the biggest changes you've seen now over all these years that have affected you, been dramatic for you?
Well, I don't know, but I can tell you what affected my dad.
Yeah,
that'd be good. Came up here one summer, and he says to my husband, "You know, Herman, I just found out that there's a machine that can take a tree and pull it in, cut all the branches off, grind it all up, and shove it into a pickup truck." And he said, "It's down at Hovland." And he said, "I sure would like to see that." And so we drove down to Hovland and watched this. My dad could not believe it. He said, "Do you know how long it would take me to cut all those branches off, cut them all up, and put the sawdust up into the truck?" So he was amazed at that. But, you know, my parents really took to the new things fine, mm-hmm. You know, and my dad loved sports. And so they got TV. He was in seventh heaven watching hockey and and baseball and all those things.
Sure.
And so, and they lived on the lake till they died. My mom was 86, and she had a stroke, and my dad was 91. I don't know why he died. His heart beat for a long time after he passed away. He didn't breathe anymore. So the doctor said, "Boy, he sure had a strong heart, you know." And he worked so hard.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, everything they did.
Right.
One thing that I've been thinking about, when you live that remotely, health is very important, and learning how to take care of your health and use what you have available. Was he able to find and learn through the natives herbs to use to stay healthy, et cetera?
Yep, he always knew. In one of her journals, she said, "Oh, Maddie," that was a neighbor that moved in up there, "got a bad cough. Charlie's got to go out and get some white pine and cook up some syrup." And so, yeah, we had homemade things. And my dad could tell the weather. He was just like the Indians. It was unbelievable.
Now, did some of those things pass on to you then as well?
No. Do you think us kids realize why? You would say, "It's going to snow. You better get ready and go back to school early." And it would snow every time you thought it was going to snow. And did we ask him how he knew?
No. Oh, sure.
And you know,
he didn't happen to tell you.
No.
You know, I have so many things here, and you're so delightful to talk to. It'd be great if we had you on for a couple of hours, but we don't have the time. I had a couple of things I would like to ask. One thing I read about in Beatrice's book was about Otto the Greeter. Were you familiar with him? He was kind of a strange character,
right,
in the community.
He had come up here and worked at a logging camp as a bookkeeper and for one of the big loggings, and he loved it up here. He liked to fish. And he was I think he was a count from Norway, and he stuttered, and he had a drinking problem. And so we understood that he...
Maybe that's why he stuttered.
Well, yeah.
that he was paid so much to stay away from home. But we don't know if that's true or not.
Okay.
But he was really an educated man. And he came then and did books for my dad. And he was always a good friend of my folks. Lived with us all those years. And he'd go on these binges and drink for days. Then he'd be fine for a few more weeks and stuff. But my dad always put up with him. And he could speak and write 7 different languages. And so people in the county would want him to help them when they got letters from people over in Europe. And he could have made such a good living doing that. But he loved to fish and eat those fish.
And, sure.
And so he was a fixture at our place. But you know, my folks kind of adopted all the people, old Billy Needham and all these old men that lived up there. They all came for Christmas and all the holidays. They were family, you know. Yeah, it was great being raised up there.
I used to pick strawberries when I was young, and I think most people did. But they were so itsy-bitsy.
Yeah.
I mean, they're tiny little guys. So if you got just a small little, like a pint of them, you've been picking for a while. But when I read your mother's journal, and in one area I see that went strawberry picking today, we picked 3 5-pound pails, and we canned 26 jars. Wow, is all I can say. Were you a part of that?
Yeah. In the summertime, when we were young, before we worked real hard at the resort, we had to pick a pail of berries every day. And I'll tell you, some days they were hard to pick.
And they didn't have black flies then, I assume.
Well, I don't remember the black flies and the mosquitoes being quite as bad.
Okay.
But maybe they were. Yeah. But the one thing that I always thought was funny for me was my dad always wore, you know, a bandana around his head, around his neck, to keep the mosquitoes and sweat off of going into his eyes, you know. And I remember saying to him one time, "Oh, Daddy, I don't know why you wear that bandana like that, you know." And then he told me why, you know. And I said, "It just doesn't look nice." Well, he said, "Those mosquitoes get pretty bad, you know." Well, when Willie Nelson walked out on that stage with that bandana around his head and sang and got that award, oh, I wish my dad had been alive.
That's a great story. Harriet, I'm afraid we're out of time. We've been speaking with Harriet Boostrom Taus about her childhood and her father and mother, famous pioneers here in Cook County. Harriet, I hope that you're able to come down and talk to us again.
Sure,
I will. You were just delightful to have in studio.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.